chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab.
Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host.
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
How you doing? Boy, in England, it's cold over there, isn't it? Boy, it's freezing, 10 degrees below zero, and my gosh, snowing everywhere. It's blizzard all over England.
Yeah, things are crazy all over, that's for sure.
But I guess we have global warming, right?
Yeah, this ice age is coming upon us. Who knows?
Tonight we have just an extraordinarily fine guest that's coming up here in just a second. Let me tell you about him. Satyajit Das was a former trader who worked for Citigroup and Merrill Lynch, as well as a corporate treasurer. He's a global authority on and authority of several key reference books and works on derivatives and risk management. He's also the author of Traders, Guns, and Money, Knowns and Unknowns in the Dazzling World of Derivatives. It's a Financial Times Prentice Hall publication. Financial Times of London said this about the book: fascinating reading, explaining not only the high-minded theory behind the business and its various products, but the sometimes sordid reality of the industry. In the 2006 book and subsequent, he's revised it in 2010, so it's up to date now. He published about the crisis, the money crisis, and he's made some predictions, and we're going to ask him in a few minutes about some of those predictions that have come true. But welcome to our program, Doc.
It's my pleasure to be with you, George and Charlotte.
Okay. You made some predictions, what, back in 2007, was it? Is that about approximately the date?
Well, you have to go back a bit in history. The book itself was written in the period 2003 to 2005. And when I started to write the book, I really didn't have in mind the global financial crisis that was going to occur in 2007. But as I started to put the book together, it became very clear to me that there was things going on in financial markets and in money matters and indeed in the global economy, which was not going to end well. Now, you have to be a little careful here. In the aftermath of the global financial crisis, it seems to me everybody, but I mean everybody, predicted the crisis. So I'm not going to say that I got everything right. What I did say was I think some of the elements of what I call mad money, which is things like derivatives, was creating a problem, which was going to be extraordinarily, extraordinarily important. And the most worrying thing for me was everybody seemed to be blithely unaware of it or ignoring it. And unfortunately, my worst predictions were that there was going to be a global credit crash, which did occur. And the most amusing thing about all of that is now that the same people who apparently predicted it but now are saying they'll be coming out of it, yet I see no signs that the crisis is A, over, and B, the key issues which caused it have changed.
Right. You said in one of your articles recently that they've created so much money and no one knows really the outcome of all that money, loose money, or mad money that's been created out there worldwide. Would that be a good assessment or accurate?
Look, I think that's probably a good place to start. I mean, everybody has this sort of strange sort of version of reality which says that this problem was caused in the last few years. It really wasn't. It's been going on since the early 1970s, which is that what has happened.
Yes, sir. Okay. Yeah, we're going to bring it back online. What he was saying, we're bringing him in, like the Ajit Das. We'll have him back on here in a second. I think he's saying he was getting ready to talk about all the money that's been created, especially by the Fed. And that money has gone out and it's credit. It's not printed money as such in physical coinage and printed money. It's actually credits. And that credit has gone out and is on deposits throughout the world. And it's just, he calls it mad money, you know. And so it's one of those things that nobody knows the exact outcome of the Fed having created these billions and trillions of credits. You know what I'm talking about, Charlotte? Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to be interviewing here, Dawson, in a second. We'll bring it back up. And he has some very, very interesting things to say. There have been tremendous trade imbalances, welcome back,
George, Dawson. I'm sorry. I think it must have been Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve listening in. They decided, that was a danger to them.
Well, Doss, you know what's interesting is we've had a hard time getting into our website for about the last 3 hours from the web.
Really?
Okay. Yes, sir.
Well, I think we should put it down to a mutual conspiracy.
Yeah, I think
we
have the NSA, Federal Reserve. They're closing us down, huh, Doss?
That's right. I think that's right. I think I don't care who it is, but somebody. But coming back to where we were.
Yes,
I think
sir.
I was
yeah,
saying,
continue on.
I think
yeah.
The whole thing is that this problem has been around for 30 or 40 years, and to go put it back into perspective, I think money changed. Money was originally just a means of exchange, a store of value, and then what happened was somehow money got out of control. And money got out of control in the sense that we basically started to see money as a way of making more money, which then became a way of making more money. And what actually then happened was we got these strange, extravagant forms of money, like derivatives, like securitization. And what that did was effectively create a strange kind of wealth. And I'll explain what I mean by that. If you actually look at a person's house is a form of shelter. It's where they live, where they work, all of those types of things. But suddenly, miraculously, what happens is there's a flood of money coming into the world, and you can use that money to go and buy houses, okay? But if everybody has a lot of money, what happens? The price of those houses goes up. And so what happens is if you own a house, you suddenly get this illusion that you're richer. So what then the bankers come along and do and say, well, why don't you borrow against that value of your house? The problem with all of that is that the borrowing is real in the sense that you have to pay it back, but the value of your house, if you like, was created by this flood of money which forced up the value of your house artificially. And in a nutshell, that happened not only in the U.S. housing market, that happened in housing markets in various parts of the world, but that occurred in almost every form of wealth and investment, like stocks, like in other types of assets like commodities and so forth. So we lived in a strange sort of hallucinatory world where what we were doing is basically borrowing more and more but pretending we were getting wealthier and wealthier. And what the bankers did was find new ways to create debt. Now, John Kenneth Galbraith, the economist, once noted that there's really not much innovation in finance. It's just debt, and we just call it different things and we make it up into different names and fancier names. But at the end of it all, it's a debt. And so we had this huge, huge debt-fueled society that came along. Now, the other thing you just mentioned, I noted, global imbalances, and that's actually interesting because people think of debt as a country-specific issue. But what also happened is that what we need to basically see is that the global market also became driven
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield, and welcome back to our special guest, Sarajit Das. I hope I said that properly. Author of
Charlotte, everybody calls me Das. It's just easier all around because nobody can pronounce my first name. It was a bit of a tongue twister. But coming back to what we were saying, we were talking about the buildup of debt. The next thing is that, you know, as I was starting to say, countries started to do this, and this is famously known as the China-America imbalance. Now, what that meant was the Chinese have massive savings, and also, because they save around about probably between 30 and 50% of their income for a whole bunch of reasons, and then also the Chinese export more than they import. Again, there is some controversy about why that occurs, but to some extent, leaving that to one side, what that did was give them a massive store of wealth, which is about $2.7 trillion today. Now, what happened in this world of debt is that money was actually lent overseas, and a lot of it went into the United States. So essentially what was happening was this strange sort of circular flow of money. The Chinese were exporting more. They were making more money. They had more savings, which are called foreign exchange reserves. They had domestic savings, which is the Chinese people's savings. They were then sending that to the United States. And the United States allowed this borrowing to basically keep its interest rates low, which basically allowed them to buy more Chinese goods, creating an even greater degree of this circulation of money. Now, in some ways, this is kind of a bizarre world, and it found its manifestation in a couple of really strange places, like Ireland and Iceland. In Iceland, for instance, the whole economy became driven by four or five large banks to the point where the total debt of the banking system was like 8.5 times the size of the Icelandic economy. And so the whole thing that we're talking about coming apart in, say, the period 2007 to today has its origins in debt. And the world just has too much debt, and we just won't face up to it. And that's really, in a nub, the problem we have. And what the policymakers have done over the last probably, I suppose, 3 years is spend a lot of time denying that it's a problem. And but we're seeing signs that it's becoming bigger and bigger problem with places like Greece, now Ireland, and what almost certainly will follow, which is Portugal, Spain, and perhaps Italy and Belgium, which will create huge stresses in the system. And ultimately, attention will come back to the U.S., which, of course, has the biggest government borrowings of any country in the world.
Right. Those Eurozone countries, has one of the problems been that they've been overspending on their social programs and so forth, and the production is not kept up with that type of spending?
Well, I think if you look at Europe, I mean, Leo Tolstoy, the famous Russian novelist, once remarked that, you know, all happy families are alike and all unhappy families are unhappy in different ways. So I think basically if you look at the Eurozone countries, that holds true. And let's go through what we call the pigs. The pigs are basically, I actually am very fond of pigs. They're very useful creatures. But in the case of European pigs, they're very fairly toxic. And this is known as Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. And as you know, George, earlier in the year, Greece had huge problems. So let's start with Greece. What was the problem with Greece?
Well, I think Italy is in there too, isn't it?
Yeah, sometimes we get pigs, which is misspelled with two I's, and that's what we get.
So Italy
that's
and
right.
Ireland, yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. And right. If you go to Greece, what happened was the Greek economy is a fairly small economy. It's a small country with a limited economic base. Now, what happened is when they became part of the European Union and ultimately became part of the euro single currency, they received massive inflows of money from the European Union. But that in itself was not the cause of the problem. When they joined the euro, their interest rates fell. And as their interest rates fell from, say, double digits, like 10 or 12%, to down to 3 to 5%, it set off this amazing borrowing boom in Greece, which was construction, but the government itself could suddenly start to borrow huge amounts of money, and they spent a lot of money on social welfare. That was the first one that became a problem. Now, you look at, for instance, Spain, there are similarities. But in that case, it was a massive construction and housing and generally real estate boom fed by cheap interest rates. Ireland, however, was probably the most surreal place of all of them because they had all of the features of Greece, Spain, and then some. Because believe it or not, Ireland became one of the financial centers of Europe. And in the Irish docks, they set up a special thing called the Irish International Financial Center, which has to be an oxymoron in some shape or form. And that became the center of activity, which is now obviously in the aftermath of the financial crisis collapsed with huge consequences for Ireland. So each of those countries has differences, but there's one unmistakable commonality to all of them, which is the countries have borrowed far too much. And there's a very famous Bruce Springsteen song that, you know, a man has debts that an honest man can't pay back. And these countries have just no way known to mankind that they're going to be able to pay this debt back. To give you some idea also of the ludicrousness of the response of the European Union, the European Union believes that more debt will solve the problem. So at the moment, as you know, they're lending Greece more money. Now, and they also have the IMF and the European Union in there trying to sort of correct the economy. But their best forecast is Greek debt will rise from 270 billion euros, which is about probably give or take around about $370 billion. It'll rise, even with the best plan in the world, to 340 billion euros, which is an increase of around about a quarter. And what I don't really understand is if they can't service and pay back 270 billion euros in debt, how the hell are they going to pay back 340 billion euros in debt in 5 years' time when the economy is going to be smaller and basically not have the productive capacity? So it's just a ludicrous proposition. But at the moment, our politicians and policymakers seem to be in a state of disbelief or cognitive dissonance and believe that this can work. It's quite eerie, actually.
Well, we're headed for just chaos. Do you see sometime in the future some kind of an international debt conference to try to write down some of this debt or write it off to get it manageable again or not?
Well, to some extent, I think, you know the old story, George, of, you know, a farmer standing by the side of the road and somebody pulls up in a car and says to him, you know, I want to go to X. How do I get there? And the farmer sort of chews on his tobacco and says to him, well, if you were to go to X, I wouldn't start here. And it's a bit like we've got that sort of problem. We've got all this debt. And we're all sort of saying, well, if we didn't have this debt, what would we do? Now, the reality is we've got to look at two things. Okay, one is what happened to the debt. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with borrowing money, because if you borrow money and use it productively, like build factories, build schools, which turns out people who can go out and be productive, nothing wrong with that. Except we use most of this money for consumption, and that's the big problem. So at some point in time, we are going to have to face up to the piper and write off some of this debt, which, as we can talk about, will be very damaging to the banking system of the world, which might set off the next crisis.
Okay, let's touch on that when we come back. Thank you for being with us. We'll be right back. Yeah, okay. We got into the G20. We were talking about the banks and what effect that this financial, actually it's been more of a financial crisis than anything that I've been able to discern. And we talked to Bob Chapman over the years. Das is online with us. Welcome back, Das and Charlotte.
How are you, George?
Okay, yes. You said something about, is G20, welcome back, Charlotte. G20, have they been scrambling and trying to get of the banking sector and trying to reorganize and restructure this? I went up to Toronto, and they were just, they were madly trying to grasp for straws and trying to pull everything together. And what is your idea and view and comments on the G20 and how it factors into what we've been discussing?
Well, I think one of the key things is I think it's quite amusing to hear all the world leaders get together and say how they're going to save the global economies when basically all they seem to be trying to do is save the banks and also the lenders who have lent really based on very, very poor judgment. And going back just a tad to what I was saying about Europe, you know, the Europeans have lined up a huge sum of money, over $1 trillion, to try to bail out some of these economies. And everybody goes, oh, isn't that kind? Well, the answer is, it's kind to whom? Because they're basically designed to bail out a bunch of banks, because the banks have lent, and indeed other investors have lent, the so-called pigs, over $2 trillion. And the German and French banks alone are owed close to $1 trillion by these countries. So fundamentally, when you come back to the G20, what the G20 has done from day one of the crisis is try to essentially bail out the banking system. And to be very brutally honest, there's two reasons for that. One, which I actually think is fairly sensible, because there was a moment in September, October 2008, particularly when Lehman Brothers failed and AIG, the large insurance company, came to the brink of failure, that there was a real fear that ordinary people like you and me, if we went to our ATMs and tried to take money out of banks, we wouldn't be able to. And banks are important as part of, really, they're a lubricant of normal society, and that was a problem. The second is the policymakers around the world are now literally captured by bankers. And many, many years ago, a very, very eminent American economist called Mankell Olson wrote a very, very prescient book called The Logic of Collective Actions. And he said that what happens in democracies is over a period of time, coalitions build. These are lobby groups. And in the modern world, the finance industry has become a very, very large lobby group. And they're very well financed. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of lobbying power. So what they do is they basically take charge of the government. But the problem is there are other lobby groups as well. So eventually nothing happens and the whole thing stops. But in the crisis, what happened, because of the important role that banks play in modern life, they were able to use their lobbying power to say, look, save us. Because if you don't save us, then basically, you know, the whole of society will stop. And the G20 has, since that time, sort of been trying to balance two things. One is the desire to save the banks. And also, to be very fair to the G20, there is an understanding that the banks' behavior was extraordinarily poor, and they want to control them. And they keep alternating between the two of them. There's a very famous episode involving President Obama, which occurred at the end of, really, 2009, when he was very angry, as I understand it, that the banks were going to pay their senior executives and staff large bonuses. So he said something to the effect that, look, so we've spent, you know, nearly $1 trillion supporting the banking system, and as a result of that, they've made money. And let me get that right. Now, they're going to pay themselves bonuses with our money. And so, to some extent, the G20 is trying to balance these two interests. And I have to say the record is not good, not good. And I think what is also happening is the fundamentals of the global economy are slipping, which means there is a lot of beggar thy neighbor at the G20, which has sort of changed from April 2009, when they were all so terrified. They were actually united in trying to do something. Now it's a case of, well, I can get by without you. So there's a huge series of very complex issues playing out, and none of us really know how that will actually play out over probably the next 2 to 3 years, George.
Right. The Fed at times has been very reluctant at providing information. They did provide some information about some of the key banks that they funded recently, and it looks like many of those are in the Inner Alpha Bank Group, along with Goldman Sachs and AIG. Was that their ultimate goal, to save those institutions with those credits?
Look, to some extent, I think that there is a level of, I suppose, reluctance on the Fed's part to release information because they believe it will be damaging to individual institutions and it will prevent the Fed from doing what's necessary. But I also think, at the same time, given that they're playing with public funds, it's not as if Ben Bernanke is writing a personal check or Timothy Geithner or Larry Summers is writing a personal check, that you're playing with government money. You have to have some level of accountability in that process. And I think Professor Elizabeth Warren of Harvard, who sits on top of the so-called TARP Oversight Committee, has been one of the very few people who have stood up and said, look, you know, this is just terribly unsatisfactory. But she gets howled down every time. And I think fundamentally what the Fed did at one level was essential to sort of stop the, I suppose, the total collapse of the economic system. I mean, Bernanke is on record as having told Congress that if basically they didn't do something, by Monday they wouldn't have an economy. And I think while that may sound alarmist, I don't think I was too far from the truth. Now, subsequently what happened...
Yeah.
Go on. Sorry, George. Go on.
Yeah, Henry Paulson, actually, in 2008 in the fall, he intimidated congressional members and Congress and said that there'd be a total economic collapse and we might have martial law if they didn't pass that bailout bill.
Yeah,
that's
well,
what they,
I think
what
like
they
all
told
the...
Congress. So, I mean, well, it I looks think... like to me they used the economic hustle to get the bailout money to save the institutions. So it was a finance that was imminent, not economic.
Well, I think to some extent, I think their fear was genuine. But then the next question is, okay, well, fine, the fear is genuine and we're going to do something about it. But then what do they do? And I think that is where I think the more egregious complaints are, that what they did was basically not do the steps that were necessary to, A, support the system properly, and fundamentally to actually hold the people who had made mistakes accountable. So what they did and what they've ended up doing is rewarding the surviving banks enormously through their actual efforts. Now, I'll give you one very simple example of that. You know, they've kept interest rates down in the United States close to zero. Now, what most people don't understand that is that that actually is very damaging to the economy. One reason it's damaging to the economy is for the people who are retirees or who live off their savings. Well, fundamentally, what that has done is basically given them zero income. And that's actually also helped the banks enormously because they can borrow at very, very low rates of funds. And then on the other hand, they can lend out the money. And basically, that subsidy is worth hundreds of billions of dollars. And nobody really talks about that subsidy. And that's kind of sad. And I think that's where some of those accountability issues that you're talking about are absolutely
right.
Crucial.
Yeah, Ron Paul is sitting on a chairmanship of a subcommittee. He's going to call Ben Bernanke in and ask him some hard questions, I guess. But we'll be right back. Thank you for being with us. Taking a small break again. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with Charlotte Littleton. Welcome back, Dass.
Nice to be with you.
Yeah, nice having you. We really appreciate you being with us, and we consider it an honor with your expertise in this area. Is it sometimes the final deciding criteria that an old Jewish investment friend of mine in Chicago told me one time, he said, George, these guys may try to manipulate these markets with money or whatever, but in the end, the market will reassert itself. Is that what's going to happen eventually?
Look, I think it's even simpler than that. It's called gravity, because I think the world has been trying to defy financial gravity. And you can keep pumping money into the economy as much as you like, but it's not going to work. In fact, I have a name for this economy. I call it the Botox economy. So, you know,
really?
You know, I don't know, George and Charlotte, I don't know whether you're aware of the effects of Botox. I personally never used it. I don't know whether you have. But basically, as I understand it, it makes you look young, but it doesn't really change anything. And it's got two problems. It's temporary, and it's got side effects. And what we're now starting to see is the effects of this Botox, which is just money. We're just pumping money and cheap money into the system. Essentially, these financial gains are not going to work. And let's boil it down to a really simple thing. which is a lot of people in the world, a lot of countries in the world have borrowed too much money, and they can't pay it back. And so what are they going to have to do? I mean, you and I both know in our personal lives, you know, $1 of income has to equal $1 of expenditure. When, you know, you have $1 of income and you're spending $1.50, you've got a problem. And we're going to have to live within our means. The real problem with that is the world has a very, very bad debt addiction. And that's what's driven the growth in the economy. And we now really have to go and revisit how the economy works. And we have to go really to what I call real engineering. We've got to make real things. We don't want to play around with financial things, which are nice, which are interesting, and sometimes they're very useful. But that's not the real economy. I mean, we have to develop new technologies. We have to grow food more efficiently. We have to do lots of things. And that's really what I call financial gravity. And what I think we're seeing at the moment is the world trying to defy financial gravity. Generally, I've found, I don't know about you guys, but if I try to stay, you know, levitate off the ground for very long, I'm brought down to ground with a thud pretty quickly. I think that's what's happening to the global economy, and it's going to be a slow process. It's not going to happen overnight. But we're in for an epic adjustment, because what's happened in the last 3 years is basically a massive change. And like all changes like that, people really are struggling at the moment to come to terms with it. And to some extent, I have some sympathy for the policymakers as well, because they want the world to go back to what it was, because it was so comfortable and easy. But it's not going to be that comfortable and easy going forward.
Right. So you're talking about really a real productive economy, one that's creating tangible goods and services instead of all these financial things that have been built on top of each other. And that's where these derivatives have gotten really so exotic that it's just unbelievably getting crazy, is it not?
Well, it is. I mean, let's go back a stage to derivatives. Derivatives themselves are not terribly fancy. I mean, the people in the industry like to make them complicated, but they're very simple. It's a system of price guarantees and price insurance. I mean, in Texas, you have farmers. I mean, if you're a wheat farmer and you don't know the price you're going to get from your wheat when you actually take it to market, it's prudent to go and try to get some insurance against the price going down or guarantee the price for the wheat, which is perfectly sensible. And that was what derivatives originally were. Now, today, the derivative market globally is $580 trillion. Now, for those of us who struggle with trillions, that is 12 zeros after the 580. And the most important comparison is that's like 10 times all the goods that are produced in the world in a year. In fact, the outstanding of derivatives today is equal to the production of the global economy for the last 20, 25 years. That's a staggering number. Now, the question is, how much of that is actually got to do with our farmers and our real industrialists managing risks? And the answer is precious little. And so we've got into this lovely psychology of basically what I call the speculation economy, where everybody basically speculates and makes money. But the problem is, that's not really what the economy or anything is about. And I think we've forgotten that. And like all things in life, people aren't stupid. They'll learn that lesson. But it's going to be a slow, very painful lesson to learn. And that's I think, where the world is at the moment.
Right. The derivative market, prognosticator said that the banks had turned casinos when the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed, you know, and where it allowed the banks to start getting into Wall Street securities and so forth. That seems to me was a major blunder and error. What would you say?
Well, I think Glass-Steagall was actually put in place after the 1929 stock market crash and the abuses. And Glass-Steagall has an important role. What it did was separate out depositors' money from basically speculation. I mean, Glass-Steagall was created specifically to avoid a problem which occurred in the 1920s when certain banks took their depositors' money and went to the casino with it, to put it quite simply. Now, what Glass-Steagall said, well, you can't do that. Now, and you're quite correct, in the 1990s, the the administration, which was actually it was various administrations, really starting with the Reagan, then the Bush, and then the Clinton administration, progressively weakened Glass-Steagall to the point where it was finally removed. And that certainly allowed banks to take far greater risks with depositors' money. And I think, to some extent, I think we have a opportunity, which I don't think will be taken, to revisit the role of banking. And I, for one, believe that, you know, there are two types of banking. The first is what some of your listeners would remember is Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life, where you take deposits, lend money to people for businesses, for houses, to grow their lives and create prosperity. And that's quite a safe,
right,
simple business. And we need to separate that from another business, which is this sort of steroid-fueled high-tech banking. And I think they're two separate things. Now, there's a second subsidiary question you have to answer is, do we want that high-tech, steroid-fueled economy of debt and speculation? That's a separate issue. We need to separate out core banks from that. And I think that was the historic opportunity for the Congress and the administration to try to confront, which obviously has come out now in the form of the Frank Dodd bill, which I jokingly refer to as frankly a dud, because it doesn't do any of that. It doesn't do any of that. And the most egregious failing of that bill is it actually is like a missive from Congress to the regulators. By the way, these are the same regulators who couldn't see anything coming, who missed all the problems. They're now going to make all the rules governing these industries.
Boy, it gave them a tremendous amount of power, didn't it? It's just the wrong thing to do, huh?
I think that's right. I think why would you give them, people whose records in this area are largely deficient, the opportunity behind closed doors in the company of lobbyists to make rules? It's just sort of, you know, kind of crazy. The German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, who's a very direct-speaking individual, once summed this up very well. He said, if you're going to drain a swamp, you don't ask the frogs for their opinion. And that's pretty much what we are now doing, is we're asking the frogs to tell us whether or not the swamp should be drained, which doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense to me. And the lobbying process that's going on is just extraordinary. I jokingly call the Frank Dodd bill "No Banking Lobbyists Left Behind," because you remember John McCain used those words to describe the energy bill some years ago. And I just think what we're going to get out of that is a very complex set of rules which will not actually achieve the much, you know, touted objectives of financial reform, which I think is sorely, sorely necessary.
It looks like the standards are being raised so high that only the large banks will survive, and this is to push out the lower capitalized banks that can't meet those new rules. What do you think?
Well, I think one of the interesting issues is, and you were talking about the G20 have come up with basically these standards for banking. And one of the side effects of that is, frankly, as you say, greater concentration among the big banks. And one of the interesting things is, if you look at the unemployment in the States, it's got to come down through small business, and the smaller banks you mentioned are key funders of those small businesses, and if they're disadvantaged, that can't be a positive thing.
We've got to take care of the small banks. Can you come back for another segment up in the hour?
Yes, I can. I'll stay with you if you
like. Okay, we've got to leave the air right now, but we'll be back at about 9 after. But we certainly appreciate your insight here. Thank you very much. We'll be right back.
That was quite an interview. That was Satyajit Das. He's from Australia. And my gosh, he had so much to say. And that was conducted, that interview, on December 18, 2010. And Charlotte, I think, on that second hour had, well, the second hour, this was the first that we had with him. So tonight, Saturday, May 3rd, the first hour that we covered was with the Benghazi powerfully breaking, quickly breaking story about the uncovering of this email out of the White House. It's actually and 12-page report that contained many emails. But anyway, we're going to have that. That's on our site right now. So go to thesecrettruth.com, secrettruth.com, and listen to that. You just heard the first hour of this. We've got to bring you up to date on some of the news that's going on right now. But you can listen to the second hour off of our site. So if you're we're only broadcasting the first hour, which is Benghazi, breaking news. The second hour is only the first hour of a two-hour interview we had with Sinyat Das. Out of Australia, he's a derivative expert trader and so forth. So if you can go in there and pick up on that, you know, and listen to the second, it's very, very insightful. We get into the European Union and so many other discussions that we got into. He's a very, very sharp individual also. But what we have going on right now, and I said it about the first hour, is that there's this breaking attack. John, you know what I mean, McCain and Lindsey Graham are in a virtual attack mode. And in that attack mode, they're out to really go after Obama. And we're going to cover some of the other news first here and then wrap this up for this second hour tonight in Austin, Texas. But there's a lot, so much going on. We're going to have at the end of May, May 30th and 31st, we're going to be in Copenhagen, Denmark. We're going to be producing, Farrell Montgomery and myself and others, are going to be producing what we're labeling and calling We the People Bilderberg. And what we're basically doing in this, it's a symposium. It's going to be a two-day symposium. We have as of yet to find a venue over there. We do need your help. We have an Indiegogo site off of our site. If you could go into We the People Bilderberger, Bilderberg.com, WeThePeopleBilderberg.com, okay? So go in there to WeThePeopleBilderberg.com and go to the chip-in section. There's three ways to help us. You can go to the Indiegogo. That's when we're trying to raise the most money. You can go to FundMe, or you can go to just a straight, you know, contribution there off of chip-in. But anyway, go up there to the right side of that and click on the chip-in. And be generous, because we need to get there and we need to put on as large. We're trying to raise $24,000, and that would put us into a really major symposium. We might have to do less than that, but we ask for your help. And it's a reach out. We're reaching out to our listening audience here in Austin and on the internet. So we've been producing the best programs we can. Tonight was the first hour on Benghazi. We have Paula Broadwell. If you want to go back and listen to it off of our site, you can if you missed the actual broadcast. But she states some very, very insightful things about Benghazi. And there, actually, she said some things that were secret, probably, it sounded like to me. So she just sort of spilled the beans at a alumni meeting up in Colorado that she went to. And this before the scandal broke about her, she and her relationship with General Petraeus, see. So anyway, go in there and listen to the first hour if you miss it on the radio tonight. The country is undergoing a tremendous breakdown. And people have described this in so many different ways, but it's saying about the same thing. Whether you're talking about Denmark or the United Kingdom or India, China, or anywhere else in the world, human nature, in my way of thinking, is very, very similar, if not about the same. We have different cultures, we have different languages, we have embedded in there all kinds of different religious and ideas of religious thought or worldview, see. But in this country, we've educated a large number of people through our universities into a secular humanist viewpoint that is devoid of any kind of God-head or God-centered view. See? And I'm not saying that an atheist can't be a good person, and I'm not saying an agnostic is a bad person. Don't get me wrong. In fact, some of the people that have been atheists have paid me more on debts they owed me, or paying debtors to me than some of my so-called Christian friends. So it's not about that exactly. What it is about, though, that where I differ sometimes with the secular humanist view is that people that won't bend their knee to a higher, so-called higher power, then what do they bend their knee to? Anything? Or do they worship men and men's ideas? Men continue to fail us. And so men themselves, that's not the answer. We've got to look to a higher level here to get the answer. But anyway, we're going to go over there to Copenhagen, and we're going to have a number of major, problems that we're going to talk about. And let's just touch on some of those tonight to give you an idea of what we're trying to do. Maybe this thing is too ambitious, and I always end up with very, very ambitious, programs. And maybe I fall far short, and I probably do. But you got to try to, go for the top deal, see? Our recent conference in Austin, Texas. If we save one lady's life, which is the feedback I'm getting, the two doctors we had there, Steve Hines and John Apsley, put on a fine program, and they brought to us alternative this and that. I mean, not only alternative, vitamins and so forth, but also treatment. So it was a marvelous, insightful thing that we had there. What we had was a Fukushima World Ideas Conference, okay? Actually, Solutions, Fukushima Solutions World Conference is what it was called. We want to thank the Young Americans for Liberty for helping us get the room out there that was very, very well equipped. In Copenhagen on May 30th and 31st, I believe the Bilderberg Group meeting, the formal meeting, will take place on the 29th through the 1st, I believe. But there are 3 days in there, 29th, 30th, 31st. I think June 1st would be the travel day for the Bilderberg Group. But that's basically why we're scheduling in on May 30th and 31st. So after the first day's meeting, we might get a little bit of feedback from different leakers or something. When Jim Tucker was alive, he had an inside track with some of these people and got some marvelous, insightful, tip-offs and ideas about what was really going on. We haven't had anyone quite like that since Jim Tucker that I know of. But anyway, we're going to cover about 12 different world problems when we're there. They won't be small problems. They're going to be pretty good sized problems. At the top of the list right now, we've got to put Fukushima Daiichi. And Daiichi means number one. There are actually two Fukushima plants over there, Daini and Daiichi. And Daini means two, and Daiichi means number one. The number two plant did not have a major problem. They had a problem, but escaped major catastrophic outcomes. The Fukushima Daiichi has experienced a catastrophic meltdown in three of the reactors. Anyway, that has to be on the front burner for the number one problem. And we're saying it here, a continual catastrophe ongoing. And we link back to our conference site because there's a lot of good click-offs there that we had and so forth. And number two is 9/11, okay? And the reason why we put 9/11 up there is that they're using this in a very diabolical way to manage through fear-mongering and so forth the world's people. These are the elitists that are using this. Number three, the money problem, the monopoly of money creation. Starting previous to that, the first central bank was, I think, Holland, in Holland. But not many years later, the Bank of England would be established in 1694. And then the Federal Reserve System in the United States was established in 1913. And these insiders, elites, secured a monopoly of money creation, or we're talking about credit creation. The mints and the mints in this country, the United States, still mint money, the coins, and print actual bills. But most of the credit is created on the sets of books that the elite is controlled through the Federal Reserve System, see. And at first, years ago, I used to think that money was created out of thin air, and then I changed my view, and then I'm saying that they've taken an idea, and with that idea, they've been able to create this credit on a set of books. So they've actually created from out of the space-time continuum. Thus, they're controlling all activity within the space-time continuum. You could call it money sorcery or money physics. And if you go into our site, WeThePeopleBilderberg.com, go to the program section. You can download a doc file and a PDF file. Okay. And it'll set out my views and arguments and proposals about money here. Food poisons us. We got all kinds. It's not nutritive anywhere more. It's GMO stuff. So we're going to talk about that. Panopticon number 5, the surveillance grid, the NSA debate. I worked for the Army Security Agency in Germany on top of the Teufelsberg in West Berlin in 1965, and I've got some insights there. Number 6, the delusion. We've been educated into a delusional state. And what I mean by that is that we don't have very accurate information. We have a lot of knowledge and information, but some of it is not that accurate. So the manipulation is done through this top-level inaccuracy of what we don't know, see. Number 7 is environmental issues. We're looking at it from a political manipulation viewpoint, even though the environment was a problem. Big chemical manufacturers in this country and oil plants and stuff needed to be cleaned up. So I'm on the environmentalist side on that. As far as taking this thing to global warming and all that, I would have to talk about that. That's argumentative. That's in question in some places. Anyway, and then we've got communication, see. My idea on communication is to provide total communication, unrestricted, unfettered communications, and the ability to individuals to encrypt totally as much as they want between individuals. But to deny top secret encryption and so forth to governments, meaning that all governments would then become transparent and the citizens could see when they were getting ripped off or the plundering of government was ongoing. Number 10, medicine. We need a modern medical model is flawed. The existing modern medical model is flawed. We need more and more alternative nutritional and all supplements and things like that. I think many of the doctors begin to practice some of that. The pharmaceutical industry is medicating us through over-medication into death. Okay, that's number 11. Number 12, the biggest problem is hatred and non-forgiveness. We will not forgive others, so we're continually tied up in hating and resenting and not overcoming that. So the people at the fairly top, people ask me, who is they? You know, I keep saying they. But the people at the very top are continuously pitting us and dividing us and distracting us and creating division and conflict between us, between countries, between individuals, and so forth. So we've got to start coming together and unifying and become together and not be divided, see. In unity, there is strength, and in strength, there is power. And so when we become unified through internet and all these other mechanisms of which the elitists are trying to keep us from fully exploring and fully developing soon, they're beginning to see now that many of the knowledge and all the differing ideas on the internet do. The internet works in this way, okay? Is with everything on there, you can easily divide people with all the different views on there and get people to fighting even on the internet, and that's what I see going on all the time. I see young bulls fight. Old bulls sit out there in the pasture. They won't fight, but these young bulls out there, they want to smash someone with this great minds that they have and this great ability to reason and to put forward statements or arguments that are the best arguments. And so we see that ongoing all the time. So, but on the other hand, in this argument with this dialectical thing, it does achieve truth at times, because some arguments are better than others, and people do change their views sometimes. People that really seek the truth will change their views. If somebody presents a good argument or good information that they can't overcome, they might temporarily, you're full of it, or you need to go do more homework. But in the end, sometimes they'll start thinking about that when they're contemplative, in a contemplative, say, mood or mode, and say, well, maybe old Georgie there does have a point, or, you know, Charlie does have something to say about the market and so forth. So there are ways to approach this, to changing the world. And how do we change the world? We change the world by convincing people to become more responsible for themselves and for the world through self-change, self-governance, but most of all, self-activism. We need to convince people that the struggle is not only within, but there is a struggle without. But you don't do it through groups, and I think we can't win through groups. We can only express certain ideas and teachings and so forth, but in the end, overcome evil, I think the majority of it has to be on an individual basis. And the reason why I believe that we have to overcome evil from an individual basis, one of the ideas just sort of hit my head the other day is that through individual action, we can defeat evil with working together for goodness, we can achieve ideals. Something like that sort of hit me the other day. That just sort of came to me is that individuals, I believe, in this world, to combat evil must confront it. The evil within their hearts, and that's them alone, they must confront. And then the evil outside of them, they must... If they take care of their own business in the side of them, then the outside world convince others to only take, and say, go ahead and just take care of your own combat and your own conflicts and your own evil. Then the world would change. See, you don't need to go out and make people change out there. See, so, and then I don't like the word collective, but working together as individuals, coming together voluntarily, coming together, we can prosper righteousness and goodness. That is the way I see it. And so we need to start working in these kinds of areas to do the maximum good. Well, I hope you we're coming to the end of our program tonight in Austin, Texas, May 3rd, 2014. We want to thank each and every one of you out there for listening. And good night. And this little song we're going to play is Light a Little Candle. I wrote the song back in 1989, and I hope you enjoy it. So good night, and God bless all of you. Good night.